Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today we're joined by Philip Tyrone. He's the owner of the Mortgage Equity Group. He's got 10 years experience as a mortgage broker, has experience with subprime lending and also A-paper lending, and is also author of the book, 7 Steps to 720 FICO Score, one of the top sellers for Nightingale Conant. Philip, we welcome you to the show.
Bruce, it's great to be here.
Let's say I'm a borrower and I'm trying to figure out who I am going to select as my lender. What are the choices and why did you choose to be a mortgage broker?
Well, basically, when somebody is getting a home loan, deciding to get a home loan, they have basically two choices. One, they can go to a retail branch of any bank, Washington Mutual, Wells Fargo, Countrywide, or they can go to a broker. Now, in a broker, what we do is we work with all the banks, Wells Fargo, the Washington Mutuals, the Countrywides, and we choose what loan program best fits for the borrower.
Okay, so you have more flexibility than any one lender might.
Well, definitely. I mean, for example, last year, 27% of our business went to Countrywide. So 27% of the time, we actually took the loan to Countrywide.
Okay.
However, 73% of the time, Countrywide either didn't have the right program for the borrower or their rates were higher. And the thing is, with retail lenders, obviously, their rates depend on how much money they have to lend. So if Countrywide is flush with money, and then obviously their rates are very aggressive, but if their money is tight or for whatever reason they don't have that much money to lend, they just simply raise the rates.
Okay.
And it turns off the water spigot, per se.
All right. When Countrywide funds your loan, is this something that they keep in a portfolio in-house, or do they market it elsewhere?
It depends on the type of loan. So whether it's Countrywide, Washington Mutual, Wells Fargo, if any time you have a Fannie or Freddie Mac product where it meets the conforming loan limits or it meets their guidelines, typically those are all sold. And what they do is a Countrywide or Wells Fargo, they bundle it into a bundle of mortgage-backed security and sell it on Wall Street in, like, collateralized debt.
Okay.
So those are what's sold. So whenever I have a client who's getting a 30-year fixed or a 15-year fixed or something like that, I tell them, you know, expect your loan to be sold numerous times. It's not even, you know, not one time, not two times, sometimes three or four times the first year. However, when Countrywide or Wells Fargo or Washington Mutual lends on one of their portfolio products, because we know which ones those are. Those are typically the adjustables, the option arms, or those type of loans. Then they typically portfolio those loans and service them themselves.
Okay, what if you're in the business and you're not as rich as one of those Countrywides? Can you write a loan that would really fit that parameter of portfolio loan? Is there a market to sell that in the open market, not to Fannie or Freddie, but to another source? Is there liquidity for that type of product, I guess?
Well, if we're competing, if I'm looking at this loan with a Countrywide offers, say let's talk about an adjustable option arm loan, you know, or a negative amortizing loan.
Right.
And I'm looking at Countrywide's rate sheets versus a smaller lender that doesn't portfolio these loans. Countrywide has so much more. It's so much more advantageous to go to a Countrywide for that type of loan product. Okay. Because one, the rates are better, and two, we can get around the conditions or the exceptions or the sort of hair on the file.
Okay.
Easier with a big bank like that.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess what I'm also trying to get at is, let's say the subprime, we've heard a lot of that in the news. The subprime lender sold this paper somehow and was able to play the game over and over again. Who ended up buying that paper, if you will, and making it possible for them to continue to do business?
Well, those are the Bear Stearns and the Lehman Brothers. They put these collateralized debt, the CDOs,
okay,
what they're called. And the CDOs are bought, so they this New Century Mortgage and the Fremont Mortgages packed together $100 million worth of debt. And then Lehman Brothers says, okay, we're going to give you, based on the risk of these borrowers, we're going to give you this rating of a bond.
Okay.
So basically, they pay back the New Centuries and the Fremonts of the world, and they say, hey, you have another $100 million to put together all these new loans. And over the course of the last 2-3 years, these loans became riskier and riskier. And that's why, you know, sooner or later, when you're doing a loan for a borrower without any income documentation, without any asset documentation, and you're borrowing you're buying a home with no money down and a credit score of 620,
mm-hmm.
sooner or later you're going to have problems.
Okay.
And that's what we're at, where we're at right now.
What happens when a borrower, in fact, doesn't make a payment, goes into default, and the subprime lender has already gotten rid of the loan? Is there any recourse against the lender saying, hey, you know what, this was a bunch of junky paper you sold us?
Well, absolutely. See, so what's happened with that's why we're hearing American Home Finance, all these companies, New Century, you know, they're going bankrupt little by little. I mean, as a matter of fact, I just read a statistic, it was something like 45 major lending institutions had gone bankrupt just in the last 6 months. So there was one company, Own It Mortgage. I subscribed to a trade publication called Mortgage Originator,
mm-hmm.
and in Mortgage Originator, it gave us a free booklet written by the owner of Own It Mortgage, how to survive in a down market. And literally,
he's the first one to bid.
We got the book, and the next day they went bankrupt. And the reason why is because these, and Bruce, I'm not as knowledgeable as, you know, the guys who work on Wall Street on these topics, but what I do know is that these subprime lenders, they do have guarantees that they give the bond companies to, based on performance.
Correct, especially a first payment default type thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So when these lenders end up, when we're talking about them going bankrupt, it's literally that they've lost their funding because faith in their paper has disappeared. Is that accurate?
That's in essence what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, and literally they've come back and they have, I mean, there was one company, a subprime lender called Mandalay Mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I have a friend who worked very intimately with that company, and literally, within 6 months, I mean, they were lending 6 months ago. 3 months ago, they closed their doors. And a month ago, they were given by Merrill $100 million in buybacks.
Whoa.
So Merrill Lynch came to them and said, got $100 million of buybacks you need to pay back to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you know, if they can't lend, what can they do?
Well, what if they don't decide to help out with that $100 million problem? Merrill Lynch does what?
And that's a question for the finance guys.
I think that's what Bear Stearns is starting to deal with.
Right.
They're starting to send letters out to people saying, gosh, guys, it doesn't look like these are very safe.
Yeah, and our bonds, you know, you came in based on this projection, and our bonds are not performing. And, you know, in some of these funds, they've restricted people getting out.
Oh, I know. Well,
as you know.
What's very interesting about that, and I did a little bit of study this weekend about it, AAA bonds, you're able to buy those if you're in a retirement account, if you're an insurance company, you have to have a AAA rating. When those are downgraded, you literally can't hold them in the portfolio, so you're forced to sell them.
Mm.
They're trying to sell them, and no one wants them. So it's almost like having a fourth trust deed, a fourth straight note on a property that somebody just told you, oh, I know you had an appraisal for $400,000, but the real number is $200,000. That's when you downgrade a bond. That's literally downgrading the value.
Mm.
So anyway,
wow.
I want to talk. Let's go back to 2004 and 2005,
mm-hmm.
and the boom years. What was the mindset of the person sitting across from you at that time when they came to borrow money toward real estate? How did they view real estate at that point?
They viewed that real estate as just, hey, I just need to get into this loan. How do I do it?
Not too much concern about future risk or payment change or anything?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the thing is the Absolutely. I mean, there was no concept of, okay, well, this is what your loan could do in 3 years when it goes adjustable, or 5 years when it goes adjustable, because they've heard the hype. You know, from 97 to 2004, these people are earning on their investment. Mm-hmm. And the concept was, you know, what we heard as lenders, probably similar to what, you know, many of your, you know, real estate agents heard who are listening right now, saying, hey, I just need to get in.
Correct.
And the concept, they were coming to us and saying, hey, what do I have to do to get in?
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Were most of the loans that you did during that cycle, were they purchase or refi?
You know what? I always average right around 50-50
okay.
from purchase to refinance. So, you know, the market here in Los Angeles where I'm at has been obviously very, very strong. So. Yeah, I have certain real estate agents that continuously refer us business, so it's about 50-50.
Okay.
But what we found is that in 2004, mm-hmm. it's when the loans really started to get much more aggressive. Like we saw, you know, back in the late 90s, you know, if you wanted a negative amortizing loan or a pick-a-pay loan, you know, 80% was an exception.
Okay.
On small loans, meaning if, you know, a standardized loan, if you were getting a, you know, if the purchase price was $500,000, you know, the standardized loan would be $375,000. So they have to put 25% down. And on an exception, we could get it approved at 80%. Well, fast forward to 2004, all of a sudden those loan to values are 90%, and in 2005 we actually had lenders come out with 100%, meaning no down payment loans that mm-hmm. are negatively amortizing from month number one.
That's an amazing thing. Now we look back and see that those loans have to be underwater and probably going to cause significant damage. When the people got loans in 2004 and 5, mm-hmm. was it typically mostly adjustable? What percentage would you say were fixed at that point?
I would say, you know, as a lender, when I think of fixed, I think a traditional 30-year or 15-year fixed.
Right, it's not going to change.
Not a 10-year fixed or anything like that.
Right, it's not going to change ever type thing.
Right. I would say 35%. 40% of the time.
Okay. Well, that's actually more than I would have thought. What was the thought in the people's head as they played out the future when this payment would, in fact, adjust? What was their reasoning in their head that this won't be a problem because of, and then what was the reason?
I mean, it's just funny when I think about it, because I remember specifically saying to people, your payment's going to go up. If it goes adjustable, your payment would go up 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be like, well, I'm going to make more money. And I'm like, 100% more? I mean, like, that was always comical to me when they would actually come out with that. That was their first gut. And the thing is, though, Bruce, a lot of the mindset of these people that, you know, are out there, you know, a lot of people have the mindset of, well, I'm doing this on the side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just working as a teacher, or I'm not just working as an engineer. Well, I'm doing this on the side, and, you know, I'm going to do this for 3 or 4 properties. And if I make $100,000 a year flipping properties, you know, that's equivalent to $8,300 a month.
Correct. They just didn't think, they thought that was going to happen and quite easily.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and that was, so that's what I heard often. I heard the fact that, you know, that they were going to make more money. And also I heard the fact that people thought that, when my value goes up,
correct.
Then I can refinance to a better loan.
Right.
So I'm only going to, you know, this is a Band-Aid type loan for the first 2 years.
There wasn't a contemplation that real estate might go in reverse?
Yeah, definitely not.
Okay. Were the majority of the people sitting across from you in 05 and 04 experienced where they were in a downturn before, or would you say a great majority of the people had never seen real estate hurt anybody?
Without a question. I mean, without a question, many people, and I wouldn't say all, but many people, because of my market in Los Angeles
mm-hmm.
and the price point to entry, I saw more people who were, you know, who had owned properties before. I would imagine much more than, you know, like the Inland Empire or something like that, where the price point's very, very low.
Correct.
However, being in Los Angeles, you know, I still saw people who would come in. I remember one, I'll never forget, I was taking this loan application, and I asked this lady, I said, what are you doing? you know, what type of work you do. She's like, I'm a real estate investor. I'm like, great. How long have you been doing that? She's like, 2 months. I'm like, and I said, what were you doing before that? And she said, I was a kindergarten teacher. So she, you know, obviously, you know, going from kindergarten teacher 2 months ago to real estate investor, it's just, you know, she didn't have a perspective.
Right. She didn't know anything other than the recent market and how wonderful it was.
Right.
When you did refis during that period of time, was it, I guess, two reasons to refi? One, to get a better interest rate, and also to pull out equity and do something else. What was the most common reason for a refi?
I mean, without a question, it was both. I mean, some people just wanted a better rate. However, for the most part, it was to pull cash out or restructure their loan in some way because something happened. You know, I'm very proactive with my past clients, so I'm calling them constantly and saying, hey, you know, your loan is going to adjust in a year. Would you, you know, you may want a 10-year fix are so great right now. Let's lock this out for another 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them were like, you know what, I'm right now at 5.75%, and you know, I'll just refinance in a year from now. Little did we know that the loan guidelines would change.
Sure.
So, but yes, the short answer is some would do it to get a better rate, better loan program. A smaller majority because of a better loan program, but more specifically, the cash out to get into the next property, buy an investment property, buy a second home in Big Bear or Lake Arrowhead or Mammoth, that type of thing.
During that 2004-05 time period, how prevalent in the industry was a stated income loan?
Oh, significantly, and still is significantly present. And the stated income loan, for your listeners, you know, keep in mind these are loans where the bank turns their head on the income documentation. So there's no income documentation whatsoever. It's literally you state an income on an application, and that's the.
It's like I promise this is true, and that's the end of it.
And that's it. Right.
On the bottom of a loan application, is there anything that states if that's in error or, you know, fraudulent? There's any ramifications for that?
Oh yeah, I mean it's federal offense to lie on that.
Oops. Okay.
Yeah, and that's the thing. But you know, many banks are now they just recently putting into effect that the you know they have a separate form that needs to be filled out in the person's handwriting saying I understand that I am stating that I make $20,000 per month as a blank. You know what I mean? You have to fill that in.
That might be a little fun when you're trying to do a short sale and you're trying to come across as financial hardship, and then a year or two ago you just told them that you earned a whole lot more.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, Bruce, on a little side note, is that those applications are now being used in divorce proceedings.
Really?
So we're getting... So for example, you know, we're getting subpoenaed our loan files.
Because someone stated they made so much that their spouse is going to get a lot more?
Exactly.
Oh, that's...
So the judge the judge is proceeding based on, hey, well, you say you make this.
Wow. And to say then you lied would be basically to have another problem.
Right.
Very interesting. Okay.
Now, the key thing is here's to keep in mind, though, and here's where the gray area gets.
Okay.
It says on the loan application, gross monthly income.
Okay.
So if you are if you're a W-2 employee, well, then that's pretty straightforward, right?
Yes.
However, when you're a self-employed employee from a loan perspective, and we consider self-employed if you own 25% more of the company or, you know, of the company you work for or you own.
Yes.
So from a self-employed perspective, we put down the gross.
Like a gross sales type
thing. Like a gross sales thing, right?
Okay.
However... or a gross income, not so much a gross sales, but a gross income to the owner of the property or the owner of the company.
Mm-hmm.
However, the if we qualified full documentation for that borrower, we would have to qualify a self-employed individual off your net income.
Okay.
So it gets a little gray, and that's the reason why they came up with the state income programs, saying, hey, I can qualify based on my gross income. However, to qualify full documentation on a self-employed individual, we have to use gross and net income.
Okay.
So.
All right, let's forward now to the present. We went through 2004 and 5. Now you're sitting across from the borrower in 2007.
Right.
What's their mindset toward real estate at this point?
Well, it's obviously shifted, and now I'm getting calls from people saying, "Hey, I want to refinance now, even though my loan's not going to adjust for a year from now."
Okay.
So before, when I would call people and say, "Hey, let's refinance," they would be like, "No, I don't need to." And now they're calling me saying, "Hey, I want to refinance because my loan's going to go adjustable in a month from now." Unfortunately, because of the lending guidelines, we can't always refinance those people. So that's spread within the industry. So people know that getting a loan is not as easy as it used to be.
So when people are sitting in front of you and they've got a payment adjustment coming, let's say next month or next year, what percentage do those usually bump up? You know, we're at a $3,000 a month payment. What's that adjustable payment going to go to?
So I've seen it. It depends on the type of loan they had.
Okay.
Because for example, if it's a 3-year fixed rate or a 2-year fixed rate, what many times if they had an interest only loan to begin with. So say, for instance, they had a let me just get on my calculator and run some numbers. So say, for instance, you have a $300,000 loan at an interest-only rate of 6%.
Okay, and was that, we're talking typical subprime?
Yeah, it's typical. You know, you could get a 2-year fix at 6%, you know, 3 years ago.
Okay.
So that would be a $1,500 a month payment.
Okay.
Okay? So obviously they didn't pay down any principal for the last 3 years.
Okay,
and the last 2 years, I'm talking subprime.
Okay, and let's just make sure we understand that the people were qualifying as though that payment wasn't going to change, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
And by that, that's a good point, Bruce. Anytime we did loans, and this was per the lender's guidelines,
correct.
We qualified people based on current interest rate.
Okay.
And now, there's some lenders on negative amortizing loans that would actually allow us to qualify below the current interest rate it because they had that minimum payment.
Right.
So.
Okay.
So assuming you had a typical, you know, Alt-A or subprime lender or subprime loan that it was fixed for 2 years at 6% and you're giving a $1,500 a month payment, in 2 years when that would go adjustable, the payment would jump for a couple reasons. One, you're going from an interest-only loan to a fully amortized loan over 28 years.
Okay.
Okay, so that's number one. Second of all, the rate would jump. So the rate, like for instance, if you had a typical subprime loan, I mean, depending on the lender, you had a margin of somewhere between, you know, Treasury plus 4 to 5%.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So that's a very big jump in payment.
Huge, huge jump. You know, people always say, well, there's a cap on this, right?
Yeah.
You know, however, per the loan documents, the first adjustment can max out on the cap.
So you can get almost a doubling of your interest payment.
Oh, yeah. So, for example, say, for instance, you know, it went up to 9% on a 20-year amortization, that payment would go from $1,500 to $2,430.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very standard. I mean, very, very standard. Now, on A-paper loans, instead of getting a margin of Treasury plus 4 to 5%, you're talking, you know, margin of Treasury plus 2 3/4.
Okay, that's...
Well, still, right now...
That's still significant.
Oh, yeah, that's still significant. I mean, you're going... I mean, those A-paper lenders or A-paper clients that had, you know, those 5-year fix at like 4 3/4%.
Right.
Let's use that example. If we had a $300,000 loan at 4.5%, that would be a payment of $1,125 a month.
Okay.
If it goes adjustable after 5 years, it's a 25-year amortization, and use an interest rate of, you know, 7.5%, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That payment would go from 1125 to 2125.
What we need to do, we're out of time for this segment of our program.
Uh-huh.
Phil, when we get back together again, what we're going to talk about is some of the solutions that people have available to them. I'd like to know if the lenders that have these loans are willing to hear some stories about how to help the people not go lose their home.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk a little bit about your book, 720 FICO Score, and seeing if we can help people. So thank you for joining us, and we will continue next week.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.